But this morning, I pray that you would remind us that even greater than your promises are you, the promiser. Thank you, God, for who you are and for your love for us. It's in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, this is going to sound a little crazy, but I want you to imagine, just for a moment, don't worry about how it would be possible, but I want you to imagine for a moment that you wake up tonight and you're on a giant boat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, all right? Now, forget the surprise you'd have and all of that, but I just want to imagine that you're on this boat and you're walking around. It's pretty chilly out. It's cold, but you see the beautiful ocean around you. The sun's going down, and you think, this is kind of nice. A little different from Western Kansas, but kind of nice. And as you're walking around and enjoying your cruise ship of sorts, you happen to see a newspaper on the ground. So you pick it up, and you look at the date, and you see that the date says April 15th, 1912. Now, get past the fact that you've traveled back in time, but if you were a history buff, you would know that something horrible happens on a boat on April 15th, 1912. So just to make sure that you're not freaking out and that everything's going to be okay, you look over the side of the boat to read the name on the boat, hoping to know what the name of this boat is, and you see the awful words that spell out Titanic. Now, I'm sure you would shout out, oh no, I'm sure those are the words you would choose, but surely in seeing these words, you would panic and run as fast as you could to the captain of the ship. And you would grab him by the collar, and you would say, I can't explain why. I know this is crazy, but you've got to turn around. We're going to hit an iceberg, we're going to sink, and we're going to die. You've got to turn around. Now, do you think the captain would listen to you if you told him this? Probably not, right? He'd say, this boat is unsinkable. It's the greatest boat ever. And also, there aren't icebergs in this part of the ocean. We know that. We travel here all the time, right? He couldn't see what you were talking about, so he probably wouldn't believe you. I want you to imagine another situation. Imagine you were back in the Great Depression all of a sudden, and you walked up to a farmer, and he was really down, and you said, cheer up. In 30 years, we're going to have a man on the moon. Do you think he would believe you? Probably not. Let's just go back 10 or 15 years. Imagine 10 years ago, somebody would tell you that one of the most popular TV shows that Americans watch is about a man who dates 30 women at the same time. Would you believe that? Probably not. If I had told you 10 years ago that people in the city love to line up at a place called Starbucks and pay $8 for a cup of coffee, would you have believed that? Probably not. If I had told you 10 years ago that Kansas State could be good at basketball, you probably wouldn't have believed that. I couldn't resist that one. But in reality, it's really hard to believe what you can't see, right? We can all agree with that. It's hard to believe something that you can't see yet. And as Americans, we're pretty bad at this. We like people to prove stuff to us. We don't like to be suckered in. We want people to prove things. Last January, Morgan and I moved here from a state that has a motto of the show me state, right? In Missouri, it's the show me state. The idea is you can talk the talk, you can say you're all great, but unless you can prove it, unless you can show it to me, I'm not going to believe you. And you know, in a country where we have to deal with lots of con artists, fraud, too good to be true infomercials, it's easy to believe why most of us are skeptics. But here's the problem. We take the skepticism that we have, and for a lot of people, we walk into the church doors, and we might say, this is a nice place. You folks are nice. You know, what you do on Sunday seems nice. It's all decent. But I don't believe it because I can't prove it. You talk about heaven, but I can't see heaven. You talk about hell, I can't see hell. You talk about God, how do you prove God, right? For a lot of folks, that's a hard barrier to get past because you can't see those things. But it's not just people outside the church who struggle. People in the church struggle with this too. We read in the Bible, it says, one day there will be a day where there are no more tears, there will be no more suffering, there will be no more pain. But for a lot of us, I know in your lives you deal with those things every single day. And so you read verses in the Bible that say that, and you say, I can't see that yet. That's hard to believe. It's hard to think that that's going to happen one day because I don't see it yet. Well, the good news of Scripture that God gives us is that God gives us a precious gift that helps us trust Him, that helps us to believe, and that's the gift of faith. Now, when we look in the Bible and we talk about faith, it's all over the place, right? You see that word 100 times. One of the most famous verses is in 2 Corinthians 5, and it says this. It says, for we live by faith, not by sight. But here's the problem. Just because you know a word and you know it's in the Bible doesn't mean we understand it. And for whatever reason, most people, whether you're a Christian or not, we don't understand the word faith. When people talk about faith, we talk about taking a leap of faith, right? People talk about blind faith. It's this kind of crazy idea that you have to deny logic, you have to deny the facts, you have to deny your reason, you have to leave your brain at the door when you come to church and just take this blind leap and trust something that can't be proven, that can't be true. The problem is, that's not how the Bible defines faith. That's not biblical faith. Biblical faith isn't blind, and biblical faith actually isn't even a leap. In fact, when we look at this verse that says, "For we live by faith, not by sight," what it's actually talking about is this. The Apostle Paul's writing to people, and he's saying, one day, you're going to raise from the dead too. You can't see it, but here's what you can see. We know for a fact that Jesus rose from the dead. In fact, some of you saw him rise from the dead. So because that fact is true, we can trust this fact that we can't yet see. Do you see the difference? That's not blind faith. What that is, as one pastor said, is following the facts and acting on them, even though we're afraid, even though it's hard, even though we can't see the end results. That's biblical faith. But it's still a gift from God. It's still something that God has to give us. It's not blind. It's not a leap. It's following the facts. And one of the ways God does that, one of the ways that God helps us follow the facts and trust him, is by giving us promises. And if you've been here this summer, you know this whole sermon series has been about God's promises. And what we're going to look at this morning is that God's promises give us faith. They build faith in us in three ways. And we're going to start at the very solid foundation, the very root level of that in God's promises. So the first thing we're going to look at this morning is this. God's promises, God shows us that his promises are sure. They are rock solid and sure. You know, when you talk about a sure thing, there are a lot of things in life that aren't a sure thing, right? I'm rooting with everything within me that my Royals make the playoffs for the first time in my life, okay? But they are not a sure thing. Just when I think they're there, they miss it. The weather is not a sure thing. You know that the weather is not predictable. Anybody who told you that the lottery is a sure thing is crazy, right? These are not sure things. But in my life, one of the most sure things right now is Parker waking up every night, every couple of hours. That's sure. You can count on it. You can take it to the bank, right? And more seriously, we know the sun rising every day, that is sure. Gravity is sure. I don't have to tie myself down and hope I don't float away. Gravity is sure. And the Bible tells us that there's something even more sure than those things. It tells us that while the grass withers and the flower fades, God and his word stand forever. They are sure, they are true, they can be trusted, they don't change. God's promises are sure. But here's the test. For God's promises to be sure and for us to know that, they have to pass two tests. They have to be true in two situations. The first situation they have to be true in. If we can really trust God's promises to be sure, they have to be true in our world that we live in that's broken and messed up with all of its problems. They've got to be sure in that situation. You see, the knock that most people have on Christianity is that we talk about a lot of nice things, we say cheesy things, it sounds good, we say cliche things, but when the tough things happen, when hard things come into life, then it just kind of doesn't hold up, that we kind of stray away from the hard things in life. But that's not what we found in our passage today. Moses, who wrote the book of Genesis, is writing these two chapters, and what did we read about today? We read about two deaths and two funerals, right? What could be more broken than a funeral? What could be more sad? What could be more devastating? What could remind us more that this world isn't the way it's supposed to be, that things aren't working the way God had wanted them to? And that's what we see here. In chapter 23, it just starts out right away, and it says, Sarah lived 127 years, and then in chapter 2 it says, and she died. We've been reading the story about how God cares about these people and he's blessing them, and we might think that Moses would want to skip over them dying because that might, you know, put this in bad light. You know, they died. God didn't save them, so maybe these promises aren't true. But Moses wants to tell us about this death. He wants to tell us about these funerals because he wants to show us that God's promises still hold true in a broken world. In fact, Abraham, as his wife dies, he has two responses. We read this in verse 2 of chapter 23. It says, and Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. So the first thing Abraham does when she dies is he goes to her. These words, mourning and weeping, have this idea of wailing, somebody who is full of emotions and a wailing. This mourning, that word is referring to a sorrow that can only come from death. Some of you know what that sorrow is like when somebody dies. You know that that's a sorrow that's different from other sorrows. That's what Abraham is feeling. In fact, these words are used to connotate the fact that he went through the mourning process that people in that time went through. And here's what this process would have been. He would have torn his clothes. He would have messed up his hair. He would have cut his beard off. Imagine the Duck Dynasty guys cutting off their beard. That's what he's doing. He's cutting it off. It looks really different. He would have put dust all over himself, and he would have fasted. He would have not eaten for several days. See, he's not hiding this. He's not saying, I believe in God, so I've got to convince people that everything's perfect, that everything works out all the time. No, he's fine knowing that God's promises are true even when things are bad. So he's not hiding his mourning. He's putting it on full display, and he's mourning for his wife because he knows that just because he believes in God doesn't mean that things can't be hard, that things can't be tough. But he has a second response, and this one is just as important. You see, his second response is going to show us that God's promises aren't just true in a broken world, they're also true for eternity. So here's his response. All of chapter 23, and you may have thought this is weird, is about Abraham making arrangements for his wife's funeral. He's trying to get a place to bury her. And you might think, why would we spend a whole chapter in the Bible talking about somebody trying to buy a cave to bury their wife? Why is that so important? Well, to know that, we've got to figure out a couple little facts about Abraham. First, remember, he's a stranger here. He's an alien in this land. He's an immigrant. He doesn't own land. He doesn't have any rights that people who own land would have. So he goes to these men, and he says, look, I need a place to bury my wife. You know, I need a place to put her. And anybody would say yes to that, right? So they say, sure, you can bury her in any of our tombs. We'd be happy to let you do that. And it sounds like they're being nice, but they're actually not being nice. They're being polite, but not nice. Because the idea here is that if you own land, you have certain rights in a society. Well, they know that Abraham doesn't own land, and they don't want him to own land. They want to keep him landless. So they're offering for him a place to bury his wife without giving him land, which is why Abraham says, no, I need to buy land from you. I want a piece of land. So why does that matter to Abraham so much if he's already old and doesn't have much of a life left? Well, we get the answer in verses 9 and 20 when he talks about this land as a property. The word he uses for property means inheritance. And this word inheritance is the same word God uses when he tells Abraham that he is going to give him land. You see, what's going on here is Abraham is saying, in an act of faith, I'm going to buy one little piece of land. And an act of faith that one day God will give me this entire land. This word inheritance is a word that means a down payment. It's a word that means a first fruit, the first results of something that's going to be bigger. It's an assurance. It's this idea of a statement that he believes that this one land one day will turn into the entire promised land. Abraham is so insistent to buy this land because he believes that God's promises will be true in eternity, that they will all come true. One famous theologian, John Calvin, wrote this about it. He said, while Abraham didn't say it out loud, buying this tomb was a statement that cried out loud that death formed no obstacle to his receiving the entire promise and eternity. The idea is that Abraham is buying this as a statement of faith that God will keep his promises. I need to own this land because God will keep his promises. In the state of Kansas, I learned a few years ago through my dad, who's an attorney, that we've got this one really beautiful law that almost no other state has, and it's a very good and godly law, and it's this. In the state of Kansas, a spoken promise, an oral promise that you make to somebody is just as good as a written promise. You know, you hear a lot of times people say, get it in writing, you know, because you can't trust other people. Well, in our state, in certain situations, an oral promise, a spoken promise, in a court of law is considered just as good as a written promise. And that's a really good thing. That's a really great thing to say that a promise is a promise is a promise. Your word needs to be true, whether it's written or spoken. You know, as we talk about God's promises being sure, God's promises are true no matter what. Whether it's in a broken world, whether we're talking about eternity, whether we're talking about right now, God doesn't have technicalities in his promise. God doesn't say, well, I said that, but did you get it in writing? God doesn't do that. God's promises always hold true. For Abraham, he knew that God's promises were true. He didn't have to earn them. He knew that God's promises didn't go invalid when he found out the world was broken and him and his wife passed away. God knew that even when he failed, God's promises held true. And so we have to ask ourselves as Christians, when we're in tough situations, do we trust God's promises because God's true? Or do we trust God's promises based on whether the situation looks good or not? How do we make the determination of whether God's promise is true? Is it based on our situation, or is it based on who God is? And this story guides us in that direction. If you're ever watching a movie, you know, with your kids, a kid's movie, a lot of times there's a scene. There are certain scenes that movies have all the time. It's like the same scene repeated. And there's a scene in a lot of movies where a kid has a baseball game or a football game, and he's playing in the game, and he's looking in the stands to see if his dad shows up. And normally, like, right at the end of the game, right when it ends, the dad drives up, and he runs up, and he's like, I'm so sorry, you know, my meeting went late. And the kid's really upset. The dad's disappointed him once again. And the dad always says, how can I make it up to you, you know? I've seen that in, like, 20 movies. Well, God has a perfect track record of attendance. He doesn't miss out. God isn't shady in his attendance. God is always there. And so what we see here is God's promises are sure no matter what. He tells us through this story and through everything we've learned about Abraham that he will always keep us, he will always love us, and he will always bring us through to the end, no matter what we do. And that is a sure promise that you can take to the bank. Now, the question is, though, if God's promises are sure, where does that leave us, you know? So God's promises are sure. What about us? What do we take away from the story about us? I was looking online the other day, reading the newspaper online, and there was another political scandal that was shared, and it seems about every week, you know, somebody's getting in trouble. And as I was thinking about that, I was reminded that those of you who have lived longer than me probably saw a political scandal greater than I'll ever see. In the 70s, the Watergate scandal with President Nixon, that was kind of the scandal of all scandals, if you remembered at the time. And behind that scandal, there was kind of one man who was blamed above all other people besides Nixon. There was one man they called the Hatchet Man. Do you remember the Hatchet Man? And they said that this was the one guy who kind of did all the dirty work behind the scenes. He was the one who had the most disregard for the truth, the worst morality, the greatest lust for power. It was Nixon's lawyer, and they called him the Hatchet Man. His name was Chuck Colson. Now, this guy, Chuck Colson, was as bad as you can get. I mean, he was just... everything he did politically was dirty. He cut corners. He got people in trouble. He took advantage of people. And this man, in the midst of this, when the whole government was going after him, wanting to put him on trial, ended up taking a drive up the East Coast to Maine. He was trying to escape. He was terrified. He didn't know what was going to happen in prison. And he ended up pulling over on a raining night on the side of the road. And as he pulled over, he cried out to God. And he said, God, I haven't followed you. I've done all these horrible things. I'm a mess. I'm a wreck. I need you. He didn't say much more than that. He didn't say he knew how to fix it. He just said, God, I need you. And from that moment on, God began transforming Chuck Colson. This man who was known as the most prideful of all liars was offered a plea bargain. The lawyer said, you know what? If you accept this lesser charge, you'll only go to prison maybe for a year, but probably not even that. Well, he said, I can't do that. I'm done lying. I didn't do that. In fact, I did way worse than that. Here's everything I did. He told them everything he did and ended up sending a much larger prison sentence. But during that time, as God was transforming him, he realized that God was calling him to start a ministry for prisons, which today is the largest prison ministry in the world. Chuck Colson, as he became transformed, went from the most infamous of all bad political guys to somebody who received medals of honor from presidents, who was celebrated by the likes of Billy Graham, who spoke at churches across the country, started a great Christian ministry on the radio. He was completely transformed by the power of the gospel. You see, God's promises are not only sure, but they'll change you. They will transform you. And that's what we see in Abraham's story. We see that God transforms him. And he does it in two ways. For most Christians, we kind of, If we talk about our problems, the ways we struggle with God, we kind of end up on one side or the other. Some of us would say, you know what? I struggle thinking I need God. A lot of times I don't feel like I need God, so I struggle with pride. Others of us would say, you know, I'm not prideful. I know I'm messed up, but sometimes I wonder if I'm too messed up for God. We struggle with fear. We don't really trust God's grace. But what we see here is that God transforms both of those things. He transforms the proud and also the fearful and the cowardly. First with pride. Abraham, let's think about him through this whole story. He's a real prideful guy. One of the best examples of that is he's lied about his wife being his sister. He gets this king and his entire nation in trouble. And then when that king calls him out and says, Abraham, you lied to me? Instead of saying, you're right, I'm wrong, he comes up with about 10 different excuses. He just totally plays it all off and he says, no, I really wasn't that bad. Abraham is prideful. But in our scene today, this burial scene, Abraham shows us that God has changed him. These men who he's trying to buy land from, like I said, it sounds really polite, but it's not. I had a friend who's lived on the East Coast and also in the South, and I asked him about some of the cultural differences. He said, well, if somebody hates you on the East Coast, they'll just tell you to your face before you even ask them. They'll just say, I hate you. He says, but in the South, they'll tell you they love you, and then you turn around, and then they'll get you, you know? And he said, you know, it's just a different cultural way of dealing with conflict. Well, here, this would be much more like Southern culture. There's a level of politeness that has to happen. So it sounds like they're selling Abraham this land at a good deal, but the amount of money they're selling it to him is ridiculous. Compared to other uses of money in the Bible with shekels and silver, this is crazy. Imagine there was a piece of property down the road worth about $5,000, all right? And imagine you went to buy it and you said, you know what, I'll give you $6,000 for it. And they said, oh, I'm sorry, the price is now $600,000, right? That's what they're doing with this land. This land was probably worth, I don't know, 40 shekels, and they're selling it for way more than that. Now, Abraham, prideful Abraham, probably would have said, you know what? I'm not going to take this. I'm not going to have you mess with me. I want a fair price. But instead, what we see is Abraham knows it's so important for him to buy this land in an act of faith, it doesn't matter the price. He's just going to buy it. He lays down his pride, and he buys it. This is a changed man. But even more of a change, we see that God's changing his cowardice. See, Abraham, the one thing we see over and over again of Abraham is he's a coward. He goes into a city and he tells his wife, lie, say that you're my sister. I don't want to be killed for you, right? That's a pretty cowardly thing to do. And yet, by the end of our story, God has given Abraham a lot of courage. And we see it in one verse that is incredible. And we're going to read that verse. It's chapter 25, verse 5. An act of incredible courage. It says this. Abraham gave all he had to Isaac. Now, okay, you say, so how's that an act of courage? How is this such a big deal? All right, well, I want you to imagine if you have stocks, if you invest in the stock market, can you imagine if tomorrow you took all of your money in the stock market, you sold everything, and you put everything you owned on one piece of stock? You just invested all in one thing and said, I'm putting all of my trust in that. You know, it's this idea of Abraham's not hedging his bets. He's not spreading things around. A stock advisor would tell you, you know, you should put money in a lot of different stocks. It'll protect you. So if one goes bad, you can trust the others. What Abraham's doing is he's putting everything he has on Isaac. He's betting it all on Isaac. This is an act of incredible courage. He's not putting some with some sons and some with the others. He's putting it all on Isaac. It is an act of incredible courage. You see, what's happening here is God has changed Abraham. And if we're following God, if we believe in God's promises, he's going to change you too. He's going to change you in incredible ways. But it's not always what we think. When God changes us, it's pretty gradual, and a lot of times it's messy. For whatever reasons, as Christians, we think when God transforms us, it's like that. Now, God might save us in an instant. He might transform us in that way. But in terms of maturing in the Christian walk, a lot of times it's very gradual. Abraham takes two steps forward, and then he takes one back. And then he takes two steps forward, and he takes ones back. That's how Abraham's life progresses. You know, the reason a lot of times we think it's so instant is we watch Christian movies, and in Christian movies, somebody hears the gospel, and instantly they're this perfect person, and their life is perfect, and they ride off into the sunset, and they have no problems. But that's not how it works here. It is a gradual and a messy process. It's a good one, though. It's a process that's limited. We don't ever arrive in this life. You can be 90 years old and the most godly person in the world, but you still have problems. You still sin. It's a limited process until Jesus returns again. It involves hard work. A lot of people say, you know, if I believe in grace, then I don't have to do any hard work. It's just, you know, God just transforms me. Well, grace doesn't mean it's not hard. Grace means that God guarantees the work. It doesn't mean that it's easy, right? Just because there's grace doesn't mean it won't be hard work in your marriage. There won't be hard work in friendships. There won't be hard work in relationships. It won't be difficult. It's going to be hard, but God's grace guarantees it because it's all God. God transforms us. But you see, the last problem that we would deal with Abraham is you might say, okay, I believe God's promises are sure. I believe he can transform. But then we add in a qualifier. But maybe not me. Maybe God won't do that with me. We say, but maybe not my kids. Maybe God's not going to do that with my kids. Or we might say it pridefully, God's not going to do it with those people. I don't like those people. God's not going to do it with them. The last thing you have to get about Abraham's life and in this story that's one of the most important is that God's promises, lastly, are far-reaching. God's promises are far-reaching. We see it in two places in this passage. First place, we see it with God's people. Abraham's story does not end here today. We read the story, Abraham dies, his wife dies. You might think Abraham's story is over, but it's not over. Abraham's name gets mentioned throughout the Bible, and these promises keep going. You see, what God did in Abraham's life carries on to his kids, it carries on to his family, it carries on to his people, and we read in Galatians that who are Abraham's descendants? Those who have faith. That's us in this room today. As Christians, we can think that this Christian life is about me and Jesus. It's me and Jesus time. It's just my relationship with Jesus. But what we see here is it's so much more than that. It's not less than that, but it's so much more than that. It's a bigger thing. God's covenantal faithfulness to Abraham goes bigger than that. We see it in 25:11. This is a beautiful, beautiful verse. In 25:11, Abraham's died. We think his story is over, but it says this. After the death of Abraham, God blessed Isaac, his son. God's faithfulness, his promise, continues with his son. The story is not over. It keeps going. God's covenant faithfulness continues. If you were gone earlier in the sermon series when we talked about God giving the sign of circumcision and how that is a sign of belonging to God's people and how in the New Testament that sign is baptism, then you got to go back and listen to that sermon online. For your own good, that is a great sermon to listen to. And what we see there through the sign of baptism is that's a proclaiming that God's promise continues. In 2 weeks, we're going to have one of our elders baptizing three of his children. It's going to be a beautiful thing, a beautiful time to celebrate that God's promises continue, his faithfulness continues, and it's all grace. But here's the thing. Some of you this morning might be saying, you know what though? I didn't grow up with Christian parents, so what about me? Or my friend doesn't have Christian parents, what about her? Or what about those people who don't know God, they follow another religion? What about God's promises for them? And that's the great news. God's promises aren't just for his people, they're for all people in the nation specifically. You know, when you live in a city, a lot of times people will tell you, don't go to that part of town. Have you ever visited somewhere and somebody said, stay away from that part of town? When I moved to Leota, I had about four people tell me, stay away from a certain part of town. And I thought it was really funny because I just lived in inner city St. Louis. And I thought, I think I'll be okay. I think I'll survive. You could hear gunshots in certain parts of town around us. So I think we'll be okay. The only thing getting shot here are animals. So that's good. But the good thing here is God's promise doesn't stay away from a certain part of town. It doesn't stay away from a certain part of people. It goes to all people. But you might not see it, and here's why. In chapter 25, there's a really sad scene. It says Abraham marries another wife. He has all of these kids, and then what happens? It says he gives everything to Isaac, which we're saying, yay, that's great. But then we think about, what about these other kids? He gives them each a gift, and it says he sends them away eastward. He just sends them super far away. And you might say, well, that's pretty awful. What about those kids? He's sending them off into the wilderness. He's sending them far away. Doesn't God care about those kids? Doesn't God love those kids? And here's the crucial truth we have to see. God had to send away those kids so that those kids' descendants, which would be the Gentiles, which would be us and a lot of other people, could be blessed and saved one day. Only if the promise went through Isaac, only if Isaac got everything, could one day one of Isaac's descendants, Jesus, come and die on the cross so that all people could be right with God. These sons are like prodigal sons. Their wandering away from God opens up the door for a return one day where all of their descendants will be welcomed into God's family. And the story of the prodigal son, it says he was dead, but then he came back and he was alive. He was lost and he was found. Those kids are sent away for dead. They're sent away to be lost, but one day they will come back. They will be found alive and they will be found well because Jesus opened up the door for them and Abraham started that process by giving it to Isaac. As one pastor said, in God's plan, these sons were sent away that there might be a true home for their descendants one day to return to. So in even sending away these kids, God's opening up the door that all their descendants, if they believe in Jesus, might be saved one day. It is a beautiful, beautiful thing. And so you ask this morning, you might ask, okay, so God's promises are far-reaching. What should we as a church do about that, right? If God wants everybody to hear the gospel, what are we supposed to do? How do we go about that? How do I share these promises with people in my work, my neighbors, people I bump into, kids I go to school with? How do I share those promises? Well, it's a good thing you ask because that's what we're going to be spending the next 3 or 4 months doing. We're going to be talking about that, and I'm really excited to be talking about how we share God's promises with others. But before we go there next week, and before we end this, we have to make sure that we get this ourselves. If you don't get God's love for you, if you don't get God's promises for you, you can't ever help another person in a spiritually eternal, meaningful way. If you don't get this, you can do all the evangelism you want, but if God's love hasn't changed your heart, it's not going to make an eternal difference. As Christians, we have to get these three things. We have to get that God's promises will never change. You can't change them, no matter what you do, no matter how disobedient you are, no matter how much you've messed up, no matter what bad things have been done to you, God's promises and his love for you won't change. The second thing you have to see is that you will change. God will change you, and that's good news. And the final thing is that you have to see that these promises will reach into the darkest, most shameful, most prideful, most cowardly, fearful, tired, stressed, lonely, wicked, beat up, abused, neglected, and empty hearts, and say, you are mine, and there's nothing you have to do to guarantee this. It's all me. Now, that last part, you might have thought I was talking about people outside of the church, but I'm not. I'm talking about us. If the church doesn't know that we need Jesus, then we've missed it. If I don't know that I need Jesus, then we've missed it. We're the ones with the broken hearts. We're the ones who have sin issues, who have pride issues, who are struggling, who have pain in our lives. I'm the one who needs Jesus. And if we don't get that first, then we won't get anything else. So this morning, as we leave Abraham and his story behind, I want to make sure you get that God's gracious promise is for you and that you need it and I need it. And we have to get that first before we can ever do anything else. Let's pray. Father,